This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
This is Orange Ribbon, Joy 94.9's multicultural programme. The Orange Ribbon is the symbol used across Australia to represent multiculturalism, anti-racism and international understanding. At Joy 94.9, Orange Ribbon represents peace and understanding in our multicultural GLBTIQ community. If you have any comments on the programme or would like to ask questions, you can SMS to 0427JOY949 or email onair at joy.org.au or go to our Facebook at Orange Ribbon Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Undriven on Joy 94.9, today with Mark and Hugh. Today we'll be talking to David Double. He's a newsreader at Joy, ex-lawyer, tour guide, and recently become an author of a book called In Another Life. As usual, another interesting chat coming up here on Undriven today, so please stay with us for the next hour here on Joy 94.9.
You don't have to be gay to play at Joy.
Joy 94.9, this is Orange Ribbon with Mark and Hugh. And our guest today is the one and only David Double. And I'm sure everybody's heard of David Double.
There's only definitely one and only one of me, I can tell. Only one would want to be too, I think. But anyway, now, yes, good afternoon.
Welcome to Orange Ribbon, David.
Thanks very much, Hugh. Thanks, bye.
This is a bit different from sitting reading the news, isn't it?
It is a little bit. Yeah, a little bit nerve-wracking, actually. I've never been treated like this before. I've been on Word for Word and one or two other programs, but it's a different experience.
We've got the spotlight on you for today.
So. I can really feel it, too.
You see, I couldn't read the news like you do. I'd find that too nerve-wracking.
It is to start off with, but once you get a bit of experience, it's second nature.
Now, you've come here today. We're going to talk about a book that you've written, but we're also going to talk about David Double.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Damn.
we want to know everything, David.
Oh, dear.
All the juicy gossip.
Oh, okay.
Let's start off.
I've got the sensor button on.
Where do you come from?
Well, I was born and bred here in Melbourne. I was actually born, allegedly, at the Queen Victoria Hospital, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was up, of course, in Lonsdale Street there. So I've come a long way to get here, I can tell you. But I was born and bred in Melbourne, and I lived in the eastern suburbs out at Ringwood, East Ringwood, in fact, until I was about 13, and went to primary school, of course, at East Ringwood. When the time came, at 13, my father decided he wanted to take up a job in farming. And so as a result, we all packed our bags and moved down to the country to live. And we lived in the Western District for a number of years. And in fact, my mother's still down there. The rest of the family have now spread throughout Australia, I suppose. But
what did your father do before he decided to go into farming?
He was working for the Ampol Oil Company as a clerk of some sort. I'm not really sure exactly what he did, to be honest, but all I knew, he went to work and came home at the end of the day, but he was working with the Apple Oil Company, but he always had this ambition of going to the farm. My mother came from a farming community, and all her nearly all her members of the family were farmers, except for one that I can think of, but they all went onto the farm, and I think Dad got a bit of an appreciation of that as well every time we went visiting and so forth. But he went into farming, and I think it probably is a decision to regret it a little bit, because it was a very, very hard life on the farm.
And what about you? I mean, you were 13. You were brought up in a suburb of Melbourne, and all of a sudden you're on a farm in the country.
Yeah, it was quite a change. Yes, it was something that I enjoyed. It was a tough life, I can tell you. I know Mum and Dad really struggled on the farm, because they were actually share farming for somebody else, and getting up at 6 o'clock every morning milking cows and in all sorts of weather. You know, it'd be freezing cold, and I know vividly remember walking through mud that was almost knee high, and it was a very, very tough life. And
so, did you have to get up in the morning and milk cows?
Only when I was not at school, of course. But yeah, weekends I would often help out, or after school at night I would help out. Yeah, and yeah, remember, you know, many a time sort of slushing through mud and
other things
and all sorts of things, and yeah, and other things that come out the end of cows, of course. And what milking the cows was quite an enlightening experience. Is you always had to be on the lookout for, you know, deposits that might come from up above when you're tending the cows out of it.
It
was one of the occupational hazards, that's for sure. But
do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I'm the second eldest of four children.
So how did your brothers and sisters take it moving to a farm?
I think they cope with it. It was certainly an enlightening experience for them, I suppose. It was a whole new experience. But seeing we had relatives that lived on the farm, we pretty well knew what it was like. But it was but none of them really stayed on the farm. All my brothers and sisters have gone on to having careers and, you know, different things. So I don't think they ever had an ambition to stay there. It was, and they could see, I think, you know, the struggle that my mother and father went through on the farm. It was just something that really wasn't there for the taking. And yeah, it was, as I say, it was a very tough life, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. But obviously, farmers do, you know, make a living out of it. But
it must have been difficult coming from a city person like your father was.
Absolutely, yeah.
What about religion? Was it a religious family upbringing? Or?
Not really. My mother went to church. She was an avid churchgoer, and as a result of that, she took us along to Sunday school, and funnily enough, I even taught Sunday school there at one stage. I was roped into it, that was quite a different experience, you might say. I don't think it's something I would want to do nowadays, but it was something I did at the time, mainly because people wanted me to do it, you know.
And is that because that was probably like sort of one of the social centres of
the
town?
Yeah, in a small town. We ended up living in a town called Cobden, which is out in the Western District, and my mother actually still lives down there. Dad passed away a couple of years ago, but church was the thing, you know. That was the only thing that was really on in town, or either that or maybe a sporting club.
Yeah.
And I was a very keen sportsman. Not that I was any good at it, but I enjoyed cricket and football and what have you, and I played a lot of cricket. And the only real social outlets that you could have in country towns, was either a local sporting club or the church. And my mother was, she was obviously brought up in a church family, I suppose, and she felt duty bound to go along and drag us along as well. So yeah, we went along that way. And
but you actually left the country eventually, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, I was down there for 5 years. Once I finished school, of course, I decided it was time to move on and pursue a career of my own. And I decided eventually that I wanted to pursue a career in the law, which probably wasn't the best decision in my life. But
Why did you want to go into law?
I suppose it was because, originally I was wanting to be a policeman for some reason. I enjoyed watching police shows on television. Remember Division 4 and Homicide and Matlock Police, you know. A lot of people may not remember those, but I do. And
just give your age away a bit.
Yeah, that's probably giving my age away, certainly, yeah.
I wouldn't agree with you because
he's never heard of them.
Yeah,
no.
But, they were my favourite shows, I suppose, on television, so I enjoyed watching them. And as a result, I became a bit interested in being a policeman. There were a lot of people, though, who said, oh, you're too brainy to be a policeman, which is probably not a good recommendation for those who like to go to police force.
Yeah.
But the other thing I enjoyed watching on television, I suppose, were courtroom dramas. You know, I liked watching, you know, the Perry Mason type character that used to be able to tear apart that unwinnable case and eventually turn it around and get their client off, you know, when all the evidence was stacked against them. And so a great fascination for the law, I suppose, and it was obviously developed from watching courtroom dramas on television. So I thought, oh, well, law's the thing for me, and I went into it, and I moved back to Melbourne, obviously, to study it. I had to go through a 5-year course. I actually did a course at the RMIT, just up the road from here. I tried to get into university courses, but unfortunately my matriculation results weren't good enough to get into there.
Okay.
So I ended up doing a course, a special course at the RMIT, which doesn't exist anymore, but it involved 1 year full-time study and then 4 years part-time study. And during that period of part-time study, I had to work as an article clerk with a solicitor, and that of course I did back in the late 70s. And I tell you what, that was a very, very tough initiation into the law. And I had a principal who was, you know, the person who I was article to, who was really, really tough as nails, and he was the sort of guy that would just tear to shreds them, you know, over the smallest of mistakes that you might make. And he was one that really humiliated you. He was a bit like in fact, he was a lieutenant colonel in the army at one stage, and he'd treat you as though he was, you know, addressing troops on parade, basically. You know, he was just
so it was pretty tough.
Pretty tough environment. And that was very tough initiation.
Cool. Okay, we'll come back to David's story very soon. This is Orange Driven on Joy 94.9.
Made in Melbourne for the world. Joy 94.9.
Orange Driven on Joy 94.9, and we're talking to David Double today. So, David, tell us about the music we've just been playing.
Okay, that was a track called Conquest of Paradise, which comes from the album Portraits, which is put together by the Greek, I think he's a Greek composer, Vangelis.
Vangelis,
that's right. And it's one of my favourite albums, in fact. I think I bought it a good 10, 12 years ago, and I still play it quite regularly. It's a beautiful beautiful piece of music, and all the music on the album is, I think, fantastic. I love his music, and it's very, very stimulating, very uplifting type of music, and particularly that track, Conquest of Paradise, is one of my favourite pieces of music. I think I first heard it at the time of the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. I'm a great sports fan and love watching sport. And I think Channel 7 actually uses it as its theme for the Olympics in that year. Right. Yeah. And I remember it sticking my mind quite a bit. Yeah, and it was great.
Great. And the music we played, the first track we played today, that I was surprised to find that was Petula Clark.
Yes, yes. I didn't realise it was her myself until, you know, I checked the checked the album yesterday when I was going through it. But that was from the musical Blood Brothers. The song's called Tell Me It's Not True. And Blood Brothers was one of my favourite musicals. I'm a great lover of musicals, and I've been to quite a number of them, but Blood Brothers was one of the ones that really stood out in my mind, because it's I think about the only show that I've ever been to where there was actually a standing ovation at the end of the show. It was an amazing piece of theatre, not just because of the music, but because of the story. It was
it's a great story.
It's about two identical twin brothers, I think, that got torn apart and eventually reunited at the end of the show. It was a very very moving, very uplifting
show. Yeah, when I saw it in London, I ended up crying at the end.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a great musical, and it's one of my favourite all-time musicals, and that was a very beautiful piece of music as well.
Mm. Now, before the break, we were talking to you about coming back to Melbourne from the country to study law. Who did you stay with when you came back here?
Well, I eventually had to obviously find accommodation in Melbourne, and the only place I could really find any accommodation was with a was in a boarding house, which was run by this very strict born-again Christian woman. It was a person who my mother knew, well, not so much my mother knew, but friends of my mother knew, and I was put into contact with her, and because I obviously had nowhere else to go, she took me into her house, and of course, being a born-again Christian, you were served up Christianity right, left and centre, you know, meal times after meals and every other possible time, and it was
so
just thrust down your throat just like anything else. And I, of course, you know, went along with her, I suppose. I went along to church with her and all that sort of thing, but I think the more I spent time with her, the more I was turned off against religion, and I think I'm probably the complete opposite. She had the complete disconversion, if there is such a word, I think. But I was turned off completely from any form of religion, and nowadays I probably class myself as an agnostic rather than maybe an atheist. But she really turned me off it.
Now, studying law, you've just written a book that's called In Another Life, and the main character in the book is a lawyer. Is it
that's
you?
A bit of coincidence.
is it you?
It's, I suppose it's, the main character is certainly based on me, but he's not me through and through. No, he's much more better looking than I am anyway. But anyway, no, the character certainly is based on my life's experiences. The main character is a guy by the name of William Daly. William happens to be my middle name, and Daly, of course, is a bit of a play on my surname, so maybe double, but that's how the name comes about. But he certainly is, the experiences that he undergoes based on certainly a lot of my life experiences. Mm. So I suppose, yes, he is...
A little bit of you.
A bit of me, yes. He's a bit of a projection.
Inspired by.
Mm.
The reason I said that was because when you started working in law, you didn't stay in Melbourne, did you?
That's right. I ended up going back down to the country. The reason being that it was very hard to get jobs in the city as a lawyer back in those days. I think there was sort of a bit of an economic recession at the time, and a lot of the big legal firms were cutting back on staff. They weren't putting on new staff. So if you wanted to get established in the law, probably the only place you could do it was down in the country, where there was, in fact, quite a big demand for young lawyers. And I assume that a lot of lawyers who were graduating at the time were, like myself, I suppose, having a preference for jobs in the city where obviously there's a greater corporate type clientele, and obviously where there's money, more money to be made. And I suppose I had a preference for getting a job in the city, but I couldn't find one. And
so did you end up going back to the same place you were from?
Not quite. I went to Colac, which is not quite as far west as Cobden, where I was living, with my family. Mm-hmm. But ended up getting a job in Colac, and the firm I worked for there was a very well established firm, had its origins back in the 1900s, or sorry, the 1800s, in fact. But it was a very, very, a very conservative firm. You just had to look at the building to see what it was like. It was a building that was probably more comparable to a public toilet. it was that very old fashioned, dowdy, Art Deco type. Building, and there was dust on the windowsills, and the door didn't open properly, so you had to try it a few times to open it. I think the partners in that firm reflected the state of the building. They were also very, how would you say, well established, you might say. There was, I think, five partners in the firm, three of whom smoked very heavily. I mean, you wonder how they would have lived in today's environment, of course, where smoking is no longer tolerated in the workplace. But three of them smoked very heavily. But the senior partner in that firm was someone who was approaching his 80s and obviously lived his whole life for the law. Everything was devoted entirely to the law. He had no interest outside it whatsoever. He was a very, very knowledgeable lawyer. In fact, one of the most knowledgeable lawyers that you ever meet, more so than even some judges or QCs and what have you, knew everything about the law. Trouble was with that was that he expected you to do the same. He wanted you to devote everything entirely to the law. And he was, he expected you to burn the candle at both ends of the wick, just doing everything devoted entirely to the law. If it wasn't any work to be done for clients, well, you should have been reading these dusty old volumes of Horsbury that were dated back to the 1920s and update yourself on every aspect of the law that was ever known to mankind. And that didn't really sit comfortable with me, because I, like any young, brash young law graduate, you'd like to have a life outside the law. You wanted to go out socialising, you wanted to go play sport and all those sort of things. But this guy was this guy just expected you to just sit there and do nothing else. And of course trouble was, he had even though he's a brilliant lawyer, he had no social skills, and as I mentioned, he was a very heavy smoker, and he wasn't terribly agile either. And of course his eyesight was suffering very badly too in these later days, and he was known to actually smoke two or three cigarettes at the one time. He light one and then put it down and then light another one. And a couple of times I actually noticed him try to light a cigarette with the filter round the other way. In other words, he was lighting the filtered end rather than the other end. And it was quite an amusing sight. Of course, also, he, having done all this, he was dropping hot ash on papers on his desk. He had papers all around him, surrounding him. But trouble was, he would take no care of them, and he dropped ashes on the on the papers. Of course, eventually, you know, we would start a fire, and numerous times, you know, you pick up a piece of paper and there was a burn mark in it. You know, these are important legal documents too.
In your book, the main partner in your book is very similar, isn't he?
It just happens to be, yes. Very coincidental, but it does happen to be, yes. That's right. William, the main character, of course, goes to work in this firm, and of course says he works for this firm that has two partners, of course, and the senior partner of that firm is much the same sort of character as the one that I in fact met in my real life, and there is another partner in that firm is almost the complete opposite, who had nothing whatsoever to do with the law at all. I mean, he was just a lawyer, but by name only. And of course, I did actually work with somebody like that too, not in the same firm, but in another firm down in Geelong.
Remember reading this book, and I'm thinking, I wonder if this is true or if it's made up in David's mind. But really, it's when I heard your story, it's very, very similar.
Oh, yes, that's right. It's certainly a lot of the stories that come out in the book are very much based on my life. Not all the stories, I might add. Those of you who might have read the book might have realised there was a court case at the end which involved certain allegations of paedophilia against William, the main character. That certainly didn't happen to me, but I did.
He quickly points out.
Yeah. He gets over that. But certainly a lot of the stories coming out of the book are certainly based on my life.
We'll come back to David's story very soon.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9, this is On Driven with Mark and myself, Hugh. And our guest today is David Double, who is talking about his life and also about a book which is called In Another Life. And before the break, we were talking about you working in law and the similarities between the book and the actual job you did.
Mm-hmm.
One of the partners, though, in the book, he was a bit of a rogue, wasn't he?
This is the younger partner of the firm. Yes, he was, as I said, he was actually the nephew of one of the other founding partners in the firm. And I think he just took up law just because he couldn't have anything else better to do, but he obviously struggled his way through it and eventually graduated. And of course, he got a job with his uncle's firm, and he stayed there, of course. But yes, he was a bit of a rogue. He just used the legal
character
practices.
Based on anybody?
Yes, it was actually. Yes, oh. I did work for another guy in another firm who was basically the same sort of thing. I think he used his legal practice as a shopfront for a lot of other activities, and some of which were quite legitimate, and some were perhaps not quite so legitimate. But
so anyway. The characters in this book, have you bumped into any of the people they're based on since the presentation?
No, I haven't. Well, the senior partner in the firm, the legal firm, of course, is now dead, the one that I used to work for, and of course, I kill him off in this book anyway. There is another character in the book who is probably fairly central to the whole story. That's a guy by the name of Luke, who's a guy that William, the main character, befriends, falls into love with. In fact, he meets in one of these seedy sort of establishments that you find around Melbourne, and of course ends up taking him home, and finds out later, though, that Luke has a little bit of a criminal history, which all comes to the fore, of course, and he ends up in jail and a few other things. And he's certainly also based on a character that I met in my life, and caused me enormous grief as well, because, you know, he had not only this criminal history, but he also had bipolar disorder and had all sorts of dramas in his life and a lot of heavy baggage. And he weighed himself down, but also weighed me down in the process very much. And he was sort of the inspiration for the character in this book as well, who's fairly central to the whole story. Fortunately, this guy, well, when he departed, when he left me, he was going to New York, supposedly anyway, because he had his father over there. But I haven't seen him since. But I'd be interested to just run into him again just to see what he's like, if he's still around. He's the sort of guy, I suppose, could have ended up in jail if he didn't commit suicide or something like that. But I'd be interested in meeting him just to see where he's got to in life. Just for the sake of curiosity, I think, much as anything else.
Let's talk about...
the book at all.
What's that, sorry?
See if it mirrors the book.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
What about you, when you worked as a lawyer in the country? Did you get involved with the community?
I did indeed, yes. I got involved in quite a lot of community activities. I sort of, one thing led to another. I initially started off in Young Liberals. I had sort of some ambition, I suppose, to pursue a life in politics. I don't anymore, of course. But I thought, when I moved to Colac, I thought perhaps my best way to get established in a town like that was to get involved in an organisation such as Young Liberals. So Colac, as a lot of country towns are, they tend to be very conservative and very pro, obviously, the Conservative parties. And I thought probably the best way to get established in a town like that would be to join the Young Liberals. And the Young Liberals, it turned out, had as much to do with politics as any other punter in the street would. I mean, it was mainly there as a social organisation. Yeah, and of course they organised these big social events, and politics was only on the fringe, basically. It was only peripheral to the whole thing. And of course they loved being able to organise these big, huge balls. And they're notorious, I suppose, like if you've ever lived in a country town, you know, some of the big social events used to be either the Young Farmers' Balls or the Young Liberals' Balls or all those sort of things. And of course they turned out to be a big booze fest, and of course everyone goes along there dressed to the nines in their black and white suits and, you know, their penguin suits or whatever they are. Yeah. And of course, as the night wears on, everyone gets totally sloshed, and beer gets spilled all over the floor, and becomes all very greasy, and of course, you know, it just becomes a complete fiasco. But that was sort of typical of the Young Liberals. Yeah.
Okay, we'll come back to David's story very soon.
Joy 94.9.
The GPS for the GBLTIQ community.
Joy 94.9. This is On Driven with Mark and Hugh. And our guest today is David Double. And David, tell us about the music.
Yes, the last two tracks we've had are both from Anthony Woolow. They're from his greatest hits album anyway. And Anthony's another great favourite singer of mine. But the first song that we played there just before was I Am What I Am, which I think nearly every queen could probably relate to, so I don't think I need to explain it any more than that. But it's, I think it's a great song. It's a very uplifting song, and of course,
there's quite a few singers done I Am What I Am, haven't they?
What's that, sorry?
There's quite a few singers have done this.
That's right, yeah. And I think it's always, I suppose, been a little bit of an anthem, I suppose, for the gay community and to some extent. And then talking of anthems, of course, that last song was called Anthem, which is from the musical Chess, another favourite musical of mine, which I saw quite a number of years ago. And I mainly chose it because it's a very, very uplifting piece of music. And all the music that I've chosen today, of course, is, I think, very uplifting, very stimulating. Yeah. So if you ever need a bit of a lift in life.
So there's a very musical theme with all the music you've chosen, isn't
it? Yes, that's right.
So you like your musicals?
Oh, yes, I do. Very much so. Yeah. Yes.
Chess actually flopped in Melbourne.
Really?
Yes, it was disappointing. Very disappointing.
They even brought Barbara Dixon out from the UK to lead, and it still flopped.
Wow.
It's very disappointing because, again, it was a great story.
Anyway, let's go back to your story. Now, you lived in country Victoria as a lawyer. What was it like if you're gay and living in the country?
Yeah, well, I certainly live very, very much in the closet. In fact, many a time I tried to deny my sexuality, and I even pursued women, not with great success, I must add, but I did pursue some women to basically put on a bit of a front, I suppose, because I was very, very afraid of coming out. I confined my gay activities, I suppose, to, you know, the confines of the clubs and bars and what have you of Melbourne, but I kept it to myself completely, particularly in the early stages of my career, mainly because I just was afraid of what the consequences were, and living in a very, very conservative community, it was very, very difficult.
In country Victoria, where you lived, you talk about, in the book, for example, homophobia and racism. In real life, did you come across that?
I perhaps wasn't confronted with it full on, but you could always imagine it just bubbling beneath the surface. You know, you go to public meetings or meetings of various organisations and what have you, and you frequently heard poofter jokes and all that sort of thing. You know, people obviously mocking homosexual people, mainly because they didn't know what they were like, basically, in real life.
That was just normal for them to
do. Yeah, you just imagine it just bubbling beneath the surface. Racism, I did encounter greatly in Colac, mainly because there weren't a lot of other races down there. I mean, it was a very white, blue-blood community, basically. There was obviously a few Asians that moved down there to set up Chinese restaurants and what have you. They sort of integrated very, very slowly. But I don't think there was – I don't know whether they were perhaps warmly accepted, but nevertheless, racism, it was there, I suppose, just beneath the surface without sort of being full bore anyway, and not in your face, but it was certainly there, I suppose.
Because in your book, you've got everything. You've got there's a lot of sex.
Don't leave any stones unturned, no.
Yeah. And one of the things, you have entrapment.
Yes.
This policeman who's gone around, you know.
Yeah, well, that was certainly a thing that did happen a lot in my day. When I say my day, of course, my younger day, there was a lot of reports of police entrapping gay people at beats and that sort of thing. And also, down at various nude beaches around around Victoria, there was police action taken there against people because, well, those days nudity wasn't tolerated. It wasn't officially sanctioned by the law, even though it was sort of widely practiced and even widely tolerated, I think. But the police sort of thought that it was something that they weren't prepared to have on their beat, so to speak. And I was a victim of police action as a result of that at one stage, much to my chagrin. And as a result, over a conviction against my name, which I don't think was very deserving. But that was the sort of thing that did happen a lot in those days. Right. And gladly, we've moved on, and police have taken a different attitude and different response altogether to those sort of things.
As a lawyer, did you ever have to represent anyone?
I did appear in court a few times. I must admit, it wasn't my favourite part of the law, even though I did have this passion for watching courtroom dramas on television, but I was never able to translate that into real life, of course. And I did represent people in court, but I always found it a very thankless task, because quite often you're never able to do the right thing for your client. They would go down in a screaming heap and, of course, take it out on you, and they wouldn't be grateful for the things that you're trying to do for them. And it was a very thankless task. I felt very unsatisfying area of the law, but I concentrated primarily on commercial property law as a result.
How long were you a lawyer?
Altogether, it was, if you count my period of as an article clerk, I suppose it was 22 years. I decided come 1998 that I had enough. I did have my own practice, by the way, down in Geelong, and in fact, I built that practice up. And trouble was, though, Geelong at that time was very, very severely depressed. It suffered very badly as a result of the collapse of the Pyramid Building Society back in the early 90s, and that did flow through not only to your clients, but in turn it flowed through to you, and it was very, very difficult to actually operate in those days. And of course, a lot of lawyers, in fact, were forced out, and I was one of them. But I decided, after 22 years in the law, that I had enough. I decided that I wanted to move on. I basically gained nothing out of the law, I think. I shouldn't say I gained nothing. I did gain some things, of course, but I just decided after 22 years, I was time for a refreshing change.
What did you change to?
Well, I've always had this ambition, I suppose, of one day sort of setting up a little bed and breakfast down in the country somewhere, down along the coast. And as a result of that, I decided to pursue a career in hospitality. And I had a few jobs working in various hotels and motels and those sort of thing. I was even the dorm at the Hilton Hotel here in Melbourne at one stage. And so, I decided to get a little bit of experience in the hospitality world. But in the course of that, I ended up meeting a young couple who just set up a tour operating business. And I thought, I was reading their brochures once, and I thought, gee, that'd be a great thing for me to do, because I love getting out and about. And I also like explaining things to people, particularly, visitors to the country. Mm. And I decided that I'd like to be a tour guide. And as a result, I started working for this company that I'd you know, where I'd met the couple who were running it, and I thought, yeah, that'd be a great thing to do.
What
and
did
that's
your,
what I'm doing ever since.
What did your family and friends think? Lawyer to tour guide. That's a big change.
They were very sympathetic, I think, because they could see that basically I was burnt out as far as working in the law was concerned, and they could see that it was, yeah, it was a big change, but it was a change that was necessary. And I firmly believe, even though I probably could be earning twice as much as I could be earning now if I'd stayed in the law, I felt that I wanted to pursue a career that I was just basically happy in, you know, and I prefer quality of life more so than earning big bucks, basically.
So at what point did you decide, I'm going to write a book?
It was probably early in the noughties, if you call it the noughties, the early 2000s, I suppose, that I decided, I've had a lot of these experiences in my life that have sort of stuck in my mind, and it's probably a good idea to do something about it. And it was just by chance, I suppose, that I was reading this newspaper, and this pamphlet fell out of the newspaper onto the floor. It was about a writing school, and I thought, yeah, that's the sort of thing I'd want to do. And I decided, well, yeah, I might pursue a career in writing. And I took up this course, and it was all done by correspondence, of course, but it was very stimulating. And in the course of that, doing that course, I should say, it was I decided to start writing the book. And it took me about 2 years to write, or maybe took me 12 months to do the first part of the manuscript. But then, of course, as part of the process of obviously had to get the manuscript reviewed and revised and analysed.
So how did you go about getting that done?
I was put onto a lady who was is a literary expert. She's still around, and she provided a lot of advice and assistance in basically told me to tear the thing apart and rewrite it.
How did that feel?
A little bit dispiriting, but at the same time, it was also, I suppose, very helpful. And she gave me a lot of very constructive criticism, and that involved obviously writing substantial chunks of the book. But I felt it was obviously very, very, very worthwhile having that done, because I think if anyone does decide to embark on a career in writing, you've got to be prepared to accept a lot of criticism. If you're not, then if you're not prepared to do that, then there's no point doing the job. You've got to be prepared to obviously accept advice. And that's what I did. So eventually I put the manuscript together. Well, at least I revised the manuscript and finished it off. And of course I had to try and get it published then. But trouble is with any budding author, of course, it's very, very hard to get a publisher to take you on, because obviously there's so many authors out there, many budding authors, and they only want to know you if you've either got a name for yourself or you've got a big story to tell as well. So I found it very, very difficult to get a publisher to take it on. And eventually, after several years waiting, I decided, well, the best thing to do is to take the self-publishing option, and that's what I've done. So I've actually had it printed myself. And,
How was the book looked at? Did the publishers think, oh, this is just a gay book? Or?
They don't really give reasons, unfortunately. Whenever you submit a book for publication, usually a lot of publishers won't take you on unless you're going through a literary agent for a start. And a literary agent will probably not take you on unless they've got a big name for yourself. But they just take the first three chapters and they sort of analyse what could be done with this book. And if they don't think it's got a big market, well, obviously they're not going to take it on. And they don't really give the main reasons, but the reason they do give us, of course, is that they don't think they have the ability to sell it to a publisher, or they're not confident of selling it to a publisher, and that basically means they don't think that it's got the market. But the problem, of course, is that there's just so many books out there on the market, and obviously they've got to be very selective about the ones that they do take on, and that's why it's very, very hard to get out there.
When you wrote this book, there is a lot of sex in the book.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about that.
No, quite enjoyed it. Did you go out thinking, well, there's the gay market out there, they'll buy this book?
Well, that's right. That's obviously who I was targeting when I wrote the book. You know, obviously the gay market was the one that I was thinking of. But it's certainly out there, and a lot of straight people I know have read it and they really enjoyed it. In fact, one person who'd read it was my employer, and he really enjoyed it.
What about your family?
That's where it's sort of become a little bit hard. I sort of kept the whole thing a little bit of a secret from my family for quite a while, but eventually I actually took it down to them a couple of weeks ago, and I caught up with my mother for a birthday, and my younger sister was there, and I showed them the book and said, look what I've done. And of course, they were quite pleased to know about it. And I said, look, you know, there's a bit of R-rated material in here. So, and I thought, well, maybe they don't want to, they probably don't take it. But my sister says, yeah, I'll read it, you know. And so she took it. And
cool.
There you go. That's what happened.
Yeah. And now, of course, you're still a newsreader here at Joy as well.
Still a newsreader, yes, enjoying very much.
Good.
And still a publisher and book writer as well.
Well, yes, I've written another manuscript, and I'm hoping to get that published next year. And either having it published myself or going through an independent publisher, and I'm of course now working on my third manuscript as well. So hopefully I'll have three books out there fairly soon.
For the moment, if you'd like, David's book is called In Another Life.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, David, for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed it.
I have indeed, yes. It wasn't as nerve-wracking as I thought it would be.
Well, for somebody who's been reading the news for how long?
It's 6 years now, yes.
6 years. I'm sure the nerves have gone long a time ago.
Ah, well, that's right.
Well, that is the show for another week. Coming up next, Enjoy is Bandcamp with Adam Todd, so stay tuned for another great show here on Joy 94.9. Thanks for joining us on Driven today. On Driven, we'll be back again at 2 o'clock next Saturday afternoon with more insights into our GLBTIQ community here in Australia and, of course, around the world. Bye from now from Mark and myself here.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.